This edition of The Stack was first broadcast on the 9th of August 2014 on Monocle 24.
Baking a beautiful spread, upholstering that favourite old chair, or whipping up a simple but delicious salad. Magazines that deliver what their readers want, both in print and, increasingly, in bricks and mortar ventures. Suburban London to central Tokyo for Monocle's Magazine Medley. Today, we delve into the world of those traditional but dependable titles that are still so effective in print. Always wanted to be a good housewife or house husband? Well, one British title has been there for you for over a century. But as times change, so must print institutions. We'll be analysing the latest trends. Plus, we head to Tokyo, where men who like to take care of their hair in traditional surroundings now have a magazine all to themselves.
We wanted to show the space and to have our readers imagine getting a haircut in one of these places. So we worked to produce an interior magazine in terms of photography and putting everything together. We also introduced barbers from all over the world.
All that and plenty more besides today on The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show. Hello and welcome to Studio 2 here at Midori House for edition 102 of The Stack. With me, Tom Edwards. Today, we're delighted to welcome back to the programme Barbara Rowlands. Barbara's worked as a writer and reporter for AFP, Woman's Own, the Australian Consolidated Press, and Today, amongst many others. She's a leading health writer and is a regular contributor to The Independent, Daily Telegraph, Guardian, Daily Mail, The Times. The list is almost endless. Barbara, welcome back to the programme. Great to have your years of expertise trained on the stack this week. And let's start, I guess. I mean, you have a healthy stack of mags, which we can talk about in a little more detail later. But you've got a great deal of experience, particularly in sort of consumer titles, yeah. This sort of thing. And there's some interesting, I guess, sort of broad industry-wide developments, which have struck you as particularly sort of interesting this time around.
Yes, I mean, at the moment, apart from the, you know, wonderful introduction, you know, I also teach, run the magazine course at City University. So I'm quite involved in the magazine industry. And I think what I notice is that what we call branded content magazines, or what used to be called customer magazines, are now becoming pretty powerful and very sophisticated. And so you have a company moving to producing a magazine, which then might come into a TV channel. And so that's one area. But then you're getting big consumer magazines who have always had kind of brand extensions like, you know, GQ Man of the Year or, you know, these kind of list award things. But now they're moving into running courses, building shops. And I think that's really quite interesting that they're not so... Although they're across platforms, they're now looking even beyond platforms.
Mm. And it's interesting because, of course, here at Monocle, we have the magazine, we had our shops. We're talking on one of these extensions on Monocle 24, a radio station right now. And very much part of the Monocle ethos is that these things are not just about brand awareness, but they're actually functional, profit-making parts of the business. And there's some other interesting examples, aren't there? Some real sort of traditional, I guess, if you like, names who are following a similar model with some sort of alternatives. One particular one, not too far from here, over in Soho.
Yes, that's right. That's Good Housekeeping, which has been going for kind of almost 100 years. And it started off having this, what they call tried and tested institute, which was, you know, they take products and test them out. And then the reader's very well aware that these are good products. And so you've got a magazine that's very trusted. And now actually it's opening the Good Housekeeping Institute, which is not just a concept, it's not just something in their editorial offices, it actually is a place, and people can go along and take cookery courses, you know, they can see products being tested, presumably buy those products. So, you know, it really is, on the back of its brand, it's moving out.
And do you think these things are devised as, you know, even if they're potentially loss leaders, I suppose, to garner the kind of attention that these companies need? Or do you think they're actually cottoning onto maybe a broader trend here, which is that, you know, there's money to be made from the physical, which will delight, you know, us fans and aficionados of the physical magazines. Yeah. But you can take it beyond that. There's money to be made from these sorts of things.
I don't think it's a cynical move. I think, you know, talking to editors and editorial directors, they're very excited about this sort of thing. And I think the readers don't make such a division between the magazine and retail. Now it's kind of a kind of a blend. You have, you know, Net-a-Porter became Mr. Porter. So they want the magazine to steer them towards products. And although you still have maintain your editorial integrity, you know, the magazine, the readers want, you know, to know which products to buy, which good products to buy. There's so much out there, actually, that the more you have a brand, say, like Good Housekeeping, that can tell you, actually, this is the thing you ought to buy. In fact, you can go to our shop and have a look at it. You know, the better. And although I think it probably won't make huge amounts of money, it really does polish their brand. I think it really burnishes. And I think it's somewhere people just want to go. And also, I think there's just one other point. I think people still do like shopping. I mean, they go and buy stuff online, but they also like to go along to a place, a physical place.
Well, this is like the Monocle guide, isn't it, here? Yeah. Physical place, bricks and mortar, the importance making
Absolutely.
Those investments. I wonder if across then the industry, with the, you know, relatively straitened times in some sectors, the pressure that's been heightening on a lot of different magazines and across all of print, do you think they've maybe been a bit slow in realising that there are these other options and these other ways to explore the market?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think some, of course, have. But I think the best brands have realised that a long time ago. And they've always, unlike newspapers, which kind of relied on circulation and ads, magazines have always thought, right, you know, I can have other things, you know, and a lot of it is shows, like Country Living has the Country Living Fair, you know, as I said, GQ has Man of the Year. They're all got kind of, if not physical brand extensions, they've got events. And restaurant magazine is quite interesting, which is William Reed. I mean, that, you know, was a magazine for people in the restaurant trade, but it now has the 50 best restaurants globally. So it's a huge kind of global thing, which has its own magazine. So they're all looking internationally, they're all looking ways of extending their brand and also delivering for the reader. So I don't think they're slow at all.
Intrigues me always with your sort of, you know, educational hat on then. Yeah. When talking to sort of students about, you know, magazine journalism and that sort of section of the publishing sector, does it become part of that, this wider brand awareness, this notion that, you know, the printed magazine, or if it is an online version, is just one tranche? Do you think it's necessary to kind of impress that upon people, even when they're learning about the trade from the ground up?
Absolutely. I mean, they come in, you know, and they've read their favourite magazines or gone online, and a lot of them have not just read print magazines, they've read things like Lad Bible or whatever it is, you know, digital magazines. But we give them some kind of business sense and show that there's this cake, this pie, you know, in the magazine, digital or whatever, is a slice of it, and there's all these other things. So the industry now demands young people who have got this kind of top layer of business acumen, and so they have to think entrepreneurially and business-wise. They have to know where the money's coming from, and so we do have a module, you know, that is really important, where they come up with magazine concepts and so on. So it's really, really important.
And there's no sense of conflicts. I always wonder whether people say, well, hang on, look, you know, I'm all about the creative, you know, I want to be a designer.
Yes.
Business considerations, in inverted commas, they're not for me. Or do you think people are a bit more... It's all a bit more holistic now, isn't it?
I think it is slightly holistic, but, you know, it's not only the creative side, but also the journalism. You know, if they've got to go out and do a story, it's got to be a story with integrity. They can't be persuaded by people who are trying to make them buy this or that. So, you know, there's the creative, there's the journalism, then there's the business side. And you shouldn't compartmentalise, but you've got to be aware that all of them... I mean, if you don't have the journalistic and creative integrity, you're actually not going to be trusted, so you're not going to really attract the retail side. And I think retailers come to magazines because of that integrity.
The other thing we've talked about a little bit, actually, on the stack over the past few weeks and months, you mentioned sort of Net-a-Porter earlier. When you have magazines like, say, Porter magazine, you know, launched a great fanfare, and it's very much come the other way round.
Yeah.
In terms of the kind of creative and editorial processes that are involved, do you sort of have a strong feeling that, well, you know, one works better than the other? So if a magazine spawns a retail concept, say, that's kind of all well and good, but maybe you're less comfortable about it happening the other way round. I just wondered whether you... Or do you think it's all good as long as we're getting magazines out of it?
I think there's an element it's all good. But I think if you have a print product, print seems to have more integrity than perhaps other platforms. Whether it does or not is irrelevant, but it seems to.
It definitely does more.
Yeah. So you have something. So you're in a much more powerful position if you're a print magazine launching a brand extension or a retail outlet, because you've already got the audience. You've got, you know, who know that and familiar with that, and it's got a long history, which, you know, so I think in a way you're in a stronger position.
That's Barbara Rowlands, who's my guest today on The Stack. Plenty more from her a little later, though. Before we delve into today's magazine fodder, we'll take a short break and then we'll be off to Tokyo. Stay tuned.
What's big and beautiful and has a sunny disposition? It is, of course, our annual summer newspaper, Monocle Mediterraneo. This large format newspaper lets us go on holiday with you and delivers a breezy mix of great reporting from Med Nations and beyond, gripping fiction, bright fashion and delicious treats.
In culture, we nip the Aegean for a spot of silver screen, fancying Greece's most filmic and photogenic open-air cinemas. We investigate Rome's soundtrack studio extraordinaire, break a leg to marvel at a Barcelona hospital transformed into a cultural centre, and proudly present the premiere of our first piece of original fiction. Anne Zarudi and her fat detective are on the trail of a killer in Greece.
In the design section, we head to Italy to learn a lesson or two in how to do good-looking, long-lasting holiday resorts. We also profile two island residences we'd like to vacation in Corsica and Antiparos, and think ahead to next summer's wardrobe choices with our roundup from menswear trade fair, Pitti Uomo.
In the edit section, we recommend a few beach essentials worth clearing a space in your tote for. We also meet three holiday helpers, from the swimming instructor on the Côte d'Azur who taught Picasso to paddle, to a hard-working Lebanese lifeguard, and a French fisherman netting the region's freshest catches.
Monocle Mediterraneo is on newsstands now, or find out more at monocle.com. Oh, and have a great summer.
Welcome back to The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Now, if there's one country where the voracious appetite for print never seems to diminish, then Japan. It most certainly is. The range and diversity of Japanese magazine titles never fails to impress us here at Monocle. Tokyo-based EI Publishing specialises in producing MOOCs, a bookish content delivered in a form of magazine. You can see what they've done there. Tailored to dozens of themes, such as The Barber's Shop. One super niche title has recently published its second edition. From our Tokyo bureau, Monocle's Jun Toyofuku spoke to the editor of The Barber Book to take the temperature of Japan's specialised print industry.
My name is Keiju Sakamoto, at Lightning Magazine's editorial team at EI Publishing. EI Publishing makes a number of magazines about hobbies, and I edit a men's magazine called Lightning that features US West Coast culture. And there's a men's fashion magazine called Second, as well as the latest edition of Clutch Magazine, where we introduce things about Japan to people overseas.
So straight into today's topic, this MOOC, the Barber Book. I think MOOC is the made up word between magazine and book. Would you be able to show us through the history of the Barber Book, how it started, why it started?
We published Volume 1 in October 2013. I was travelling overseas for the men's fashion magazine Second. I found barbers overseas very cool. I became interested in them. They occupied a classic, traditional world, which was very different from the barbers in Japan. This was a time where this pomade-styled, slicked-back hair trend was beginning to take off here. So I thought we could compile something about the culture of barbers and their shops.
I think culture of barber has changed over the last decades. I think men, boys, always used to get their haircut at the barber, perhaps following their bigger brothers and fathers and grandpas. But I understand it's kind of faded away. People, young boys and men, started going to hair salon like women, other girls did. How did you observe that change through editing this barber book?
This MOOC is something of a spin-off version of Second magazine. The main audience of Second is men in their 30s and 40s. We made this magazine for them too. Like the magazine Second, we positioned it in fashion. And although we included a small hairstyle guide, what we really wanted to showcase is the world of the barber, the ambience. Say, the traditional English barber, or the cool, classic American 50s one. We wanted to show the space, and to have our readers imagine getting a haircut in one of these places. So, we worked to produce an interior magazine, in terms of photography, and putting everything together. We also introduced barbers from all over the world. We actually visited these places. For example, in Volume 1, we have Truefitt and Hill in England and Freeman Sporting Club in New York. These are some of the most popular barbers in the world today.
So who do you think is your audience that actually reads your barber book 1 and 2? And who were the targeted audience you set when you started editing, making these?
Well, Volume 1 featured around 20 barbers in Japan and, well, about the same number in Volume 2. The window was open for anybody, nationwide. We didn't mind travelling around, as long as there was a cool barber. That said, they tend to exist in big cities, where you find fashion-conscious people, such as Osaka and Tokyo. In terms of selection criteria, the priority was on a good interior space, as we were approaching this theme like we were making an interior design book. Needless to say, their cutting skills and technique are great. That's a given. So the interior, space, ambience, and service were all on the checklist.
So Japan is, in terms of print-digital ratio, is still, you think, strong on print side?
Well, I think print is still strong in Japan. That said, personally, I've purchased and tried e-books, but things don't really get into my head, even though I tend to think it's getting in there. As a means to deliver information, I feel its impact is still weak. That's my personal take. And of course, digital is a big word in business now. That was our Tokyo researcher speaking to the editor of the Barber Book, the sights and sounds of barbering in Japan and all around the world. And I'm here with Barbara Rowlands, who has had a bit of a look through the Barber Book, which introduces all of cool barbers, we're told, on the cover. Barbara, I know you've got a wealth of experience sort of in consumer titles. No beard. But an incredible style, like great elan with that thing.
I thought it was terrific, actually. I mean, obviously there's loads of beards around, and I notice you have a little...
I've got a little bit going on. I feel I need to brush up, though, after
seeing some of these examples. Need to grow it longer. No, I mean, it's amazing. I don't know God knows how many pages it is, but it's well over 100 on beards and wonderful pictures, lots of sort of different sorts of beards.
And just so many barber chairs and things you didn't realise that you needed to know about, but actually you do.
Absolutely. But I would love to have a feature, of course it's all in Japanese, about what else goes on in barbershops, because I'm sure there's other things that go on.
Well, down through the centuries, there's been all sorts, of course. It's like, that's the origin of the famous, you know, the barber's pole. The red and white from the old bloodletting days. I'm sure you meant only things as relatively innocent as that, of course.
Oh, that's right. But it's very attractive looking magazine.
It's a beautiful thing. Well, interestingly, yeah. I mean, it's called Barber Book, and it does have that heavy, you know, gloss with it has a sort of collectible aspect.
Do you think it's a sort of business to business magazine, or is it just for people with beards?
I think it's for the international beard connoisseur, perhaps. But an incredible addition. And that was Arjun telling us all about it with the editor. Fascinating stuff. So I can guess then, Barbara, that there's no other beard-based publications in your selection.
No, but there is a magazine called The Chap, which has been going for years, that goes into beards every so often, but it's not devoted to... You know.
So a passing and I think moustaches feature in there quite prominently as well. Let's delve back into the rest of your stack of magazines today. So what have you got here? Tell us about this one.
I've got this magazine, O Comely, which is a magazine for women, though it doesn't say it's for women, but it just features women. Mm. And it's an independent magazine. It's very quirky. It's a kind of celebration of young women, but it kind of avoids the usual fare of, you know, relationships and makeup and so on, cooking. And it's a lovely kind of turquoise colour with this model on the front, who's not famous. And this issue is the garden issue. And so what you have is it's also quite global. It has, you know, it's got a feature on a garden in Mumbai, you know, features on gardens on office blocks and allotments. And it's also got essays. I mean, it's a very rare magazine that has essays in it.
A bit of proper writing. Yeah, that's what
and then,
we like to see,
then
isn't it?
Beautiful kind of pictures, or shots of gardens and things. And then it writes, you know, then suddenly you come across a kind of interview with Daniel Radcliffe.
So quite an eclectic. Does that have a garden theme, or is it just an eclectic
blend?
No,
it's nothing to do with Daniel's garden. but there is the Green Man Festival, which is coming up, and they interview the person who kind of runs that. So it's a kind of pretty cool, good-looking magazine with just little pictures of things you're not quite sure what they are. But
That's a handsome old title. And I guess it's interesting, isn't it? Because people would say, oh, you know, a lot of these marketplaces are very busy, and the independent sector will sometimes try and come at things from a really particular angle. But to do a sort of, I guess you'd call it a fairly kind of straight, honest approach. It's not too cryptic, and yet they've done a nice job.
Yeah, and it's been going a couple of years now. It's not a kind of a flash in the pan sort of
thing. Some nice. I always like to see a bit of nice illustration as well.
Absolutely, you know.
So that gets a good tick from us.
Yeah,
I'll put that there by the Barber book. Let's continue on now. What about
Vogue?
One of the titans. There it is. That's the reassuring thud of Vogue hitting the table.
It's massive. I mean, I don't know how many pages it is, but it says on its cover line it's got 460 pages of fashion, style and beauty. So it is the September issue, which is the big issue. Hmm. It actually doesn't have I don't think it's a brilliant cover. It's got that model, Cara, I can never pronounce
Cara Delevingne. Well, she's everywhere, isn't
that's
she,
right.
these days?
But it's, you know, she's wearing kind of brown, and it's brown thing, brown jacket, and it's red and brown.
It's relatively, I would say it's a sort of relatively
muted,
small C conservative cover, isn't it,
for it the is,
sort of September
actually.
Issue. Sometimes you're expecting to be really, really dazzled, but maybe just Cara alone is enough these days.
Yes, I mean, and then, but it does have these kind of incredible ads, you know, which is about 20 pages of ads. And of course, some of them, there's one section of ads which is done by Annie Leibovitz, you know, it's the usual, it's not just Louis Vuitton by, you know, it is Louis Vuitton by these three kind of
ads as art.
Absolutely.
Isn't it, in these
editions. Then you actually, if you can lift it up, you can get through it. There is a very good piece, actually, but not very probing, on Naomi Campbell going back to her roots.
Right.
There's also something about a £6,500 gold encrusted bra from La Perla, I think.
Perfect.
So it absolutely delivers for its reader. You know, Mario Testino has a couple of shoots. Very good, you know, once you get through the ads, there's some absolutely wonderful fashion shoots later on. It was just beautiful colours, yellow, red, blue. This is by Mario Testino. It's not particularly, you know, it's the usual Prada or whatever, but it's done, almost look like an art factory. So you've got, there's a pink egg here, there's a green hat box, the model's up against a turquoise wall in a kind of red, a yellow dress, and it's just beautifully vibrant.
Lots of big, bold splashes of
incredible bold
colour,
splashes
there?
Of colour, you know, and one of the top models, not Kate Moss, you know.
There's a couple of things. it intrigues me, Barbara, the language, because obviously you said, you know, once you get through the ads and you talked about the sort of considerations there's these almost, it's almost themed advertising. You've got all of these big name photographers. You know, there are some people who, when they'll, you know, pick up, say, September Vogue in particular, They'll almost look through
absolutely.
That with more sort of readily than they'll even look through the
editorial
pages.
The series one ad right at the beginning, which is for Louis Vuitton, it has Bruce Weber, it has, you know, Annie Leibovitz, and it has Charlotte Gainsbourg as the model. And it's really a beautiful kind of series. Mm. And obviously, if you're in the fashion industry, you know, these are fantastic ads, and that's what you want. So it's. I mean, I tend to flick through to get to the editorial, but no. It's an amazing.
And it weighs about 100 weight. I'm just limbering up with this now.
Absolutely,
you certainly get me in shape working through through Vogue magazine. Yeah. I think we've got time for just a couple of other checks from what you've got here. What have you got here? I guess we would describe this as a change of pace from the September Vogue.
This is partly because of my health thing, but it's New Scientist, which I get quite regularly. And New Scientist is quite interesting because it's kind of got, it's much less geeky than it was. It's very, very accessible. And this issue I've got, which is a recent issue, is a big piece about whether it's, you know, the fat sugar debate. And how, you know, how do we get it all wrong? So it's very, very accessible. I mean, I'm not a scientist, actually. I've got an arts background, but this is a really great, simple read. It's slightly old-fashioned. I think its features are great. It's slightly old-fashioned in the newspapers. But also it's got these wonderful, again, going back to brand extensions, it's got these books like, you know, Do Polar Bears Get Lonely? And Do Penguins Feet... Why Don't Penguins Feet Freeze? And they always come after Christmas, you know. So it too looks to extending its brand. And making it very accessible, which is quite frankly good, I think, because most people don't know anything about science. So.
Indeed. Well, yeah, just as a final thought before we wrap up, Barbara, then you mentioned that particularly, you know, and they have fat or fiction, which I rather like as a headline.
Yes.
You know, you mentioned obviously writing about health, writing across, you know, consumer titles, newspapers. Yeah. Just in short, you know, what's the health, the robustness of that particular marketplace, writing intelligently about science, about health? Do you feel there's enough out there? Are there a few good bastions, New Scientist, for example?
But... Well, New Scientist, I mean, actually, I think, I mean, I hate to say it, and I'll probably be slammed down, but I think actually the Daily Mail has a lot of, I mean, its headline's kind of a bit wild, but it actually covers a lot of health. Whereas I think a lot of other magazines and newspapers have gone into well-being. You know, it's nothing about much about illness. It's all to do how not to get ill. So I think that there could be a bit of a rebalance into actually looking at things about illness and disease, you know, and how we can deal with that. But, you know, I think it's fairly healthy, actually, on the whole.
A healthy marketplace.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
A nice note on which to end. That's Barbara Rowlands. Barbara, thanks, as always, for joining us here on The Stack on Monocle 24. And that brings us to the end of this edition, 102 of The Stack, with me, Tom Edwards. A special thanks to my guest today, Barbara Rowlands, and of course to my producer, David Pleasant, and our studio manager, Claire Urban. Comments, queries or thoughts, drop us a note, info@monocle.com. And don't forget to tune in next Saturday at the very same time. You can listen again to this and all our previous editions at the radio pages at monocle.com or via iTunes or SoundCloud. But for now, from this week's edition of The Stack, that's all. Goodbye.